history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, it's pretty amazing the perspective we pick up. We're educated, we're entertained, often we're really inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And inspiration is the business Gail Halvorsen has been in for a long time. For some of you, just my saying that name brought instant recognition. But for the rest of you, spend this next hour with us and you're not going to forget that name either. Around the world, he's known by quite a few names. You can call him Colonel, you can call him Hal, Uncle Wackelflügel, that's German for Uncle Wiggly Wings, and maybe he's best known as the Candy Bomber, or should I say the Berlin Candy Bomber. That's the title of his book, which I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. But Gail Halvorsen just turned 100 years old and received quite an honor in his home state of Utah. So I wanted to make that the focus of our time here on the radio this week. I had the privilege of sitting down with Colonel Halvorsen a few years back to record the whole story of how he became the Candy Bomber. And we're going to hear that, but first let's hear the voice of a centenarian, Colonel Gail Halvorsen, on the phone from Provo, Utah. And it sounds like you've had quite the week.
Yeah, we're having a big time. People are really great this town.
Well, I guess I should also say happy belated birthday. I'm sorry I missed the big occasion, but what was that like for you on your birthday?
Well, 10th of October in 1920, and just like old times, like last year's, and if I can keep it that way, I'll be in good shape.
Do you feel 100 yet?
Heavens, no. No, I'm still flying, and get along good in the world. I'm having a good time.
So what all did they do for you on your birthday on Saturday?
Well, we had a birthday cake, of course, with a large number of cattle. Couldn't get them all on there, but anyway, we had a good time with the family, and you know, we didn't do any big deals, but we had a good birthday, and people mattered, family and your neighbors, and so it was good.
And there was more than a few vehicles, I think, driving by in front of the house there, right?
Yeah, there sure was. I was pretty amazed at the people here that knew when my birthday was. So it's just a number, I hope.
100 is just a number, but it's a pretty big number, and that number is dwarfed by the amount of mail he'll be swimming through between now and his 101st birthday next October. Cards and letters from all over the world, not to mention a larger-than-life tribute to him in Tremont, Utah, where he spent plenty of time over the years. We're going to hear about that a little later, and how you can help the Candy Bomber and his namesake foundation accomplish one goal that's still out in front of him. But I want you to hear some of his story. You definitely can't fit his whole life's journey into an hour. It'd probably take that long just to catalog all the U.S. presidents and foreign heads of state he's met. But I do want you to get a feel for what made him who he is and how he became the Candy Bomber. So let's have him take us back to his formative years in the Beehive State.
Well, the things I remember back then was growing up on the farm in Garland, Utah, was to appreciate food and love, and that's about all we had during the Depression, and hard work on the farm. But it was good work. It was a good way to grow up. Working out in the field and throwing hay up in the hay wagon or thinning sugar beets, see an airplane come out through the blue sky and head up north to Idaho. And I'd stop and watch, and Dad said, well, you watch long enough, get back to work. And I was enthralled with airplanes from the beginning. So that was in my blood. The contrast was the farm work every day, and it was a good life, a really good life. I don't know how I could have more love and hard work and good lessons from a good dad and mom. Out of high school in 1941, before the war started, I competed with a bunch of guys in Salt Lake, Ogden, and Northern Utah for a flight scholarship. We had about 140 going to ground school, and they gave 10 scholarships. Well, I memorized everything being in the farm, so I got a free ride to get a private pilot license, me and 10 other guys. We didn't have any money, but we pulled up $50 a piece, and that's $500, and bought an airplane. It was a Franklin 55 horsepower engine with single ignition. That means if the ignition quits, you're a glider. So you learn to look out for emergency landing places. So I had a great time with that, and we got going, and Pearl Harbor came along, and of course we signed up and got in the Army Air Corps. But that's how I got started to fly, and I loved it. I got a lot of time. Didn't have any money to buy gas so that airplane. Spent my $50 on buying the airplane with other guys. So I had a really good buddy, Conrad Steffen, in Tremont, in Utah. He wanted to see what flying was like. I said, well, I'm an expert. I got 35 hours. I'll show you how to do it. And so I gave him a ride, and he bought all the gas. So I flew a lot because he had a pretty good bank account. So we did a lot of flying together. I sure enjoyed Conrad Steffen.
Well, and you mentioned then Pearl Harbor happened, and then you ended up in the Army Air Corps after that. What do you remember about that day and how that news hit you, that all of a sudden your country has been attacked and the world has changed a little bit? Do you remember how you found out?
Yes, I was listening to a car radio. I had even had a radio in those days. good for radio. I love it. I love radio. But just the news broke up and the man came in. I thought they was doing one of these crazy shows, you know. I just didn't believe it. The Japanese, clear over there from Japan, would be bombing Pearl Harbor. It was beyond my belief. And then I thought, well, I'm glad I got a pilot license. I know I won't be. So I felt sorry for the guys slugging on the ground, our buddies that was part of the team. But I always wanted to fly. So I remember it. I just didn't believe it for a while. So I got a local radio broadcast that said it's true, that's underway. And so we were very much concerned then for the future, my buddies and I at that time.
And again, I know we can only scratch the surface of your story, and I hope everyone looks at your website to learn all about you and check out the incredible pictures if you want to learn more about the Candy Bomber. I've got that linked at hometownheroesradio.com. But again, long before you're the Candy Bomber, you're just a pilot in the Army Air Corps. Did you have an idea of what you wanted to fly? Were you thinking, I'd really love to fly fighters, or I'd like to be on a 10-man bomber crew? What were you thinking would be good?
At that time, of course, the real heroes for me were the RAF pilots defending Great Britain. The guys that are flying day and night, going up at night to intercept the German bombers. I was just enthralled with those. And Chesley Peterson was a guy that lives not in Utah, not too far. He had enlisted in the RAF quite a bit earlier. And he added another dimension, knowing the Utah guy was out there flying the RAF before Pearl Harbor. So they were my ideal. And when I signed up for aviation cadet training, and when we got to San Antonio, Texas for pre-flight, they had a notice on the board. It said, who wants to train with the RAF? And man, I ran in right quick and said, hey, I want to train with the RAF. They said, well, okay, we'll talk to you about it. And the Brits were training their pilots in the States during the bombing. Of course, they had more room in Canada and the United States. So I ended up in the flight training, RAF training in Miami, Oklahoma. That's how I got into the business and ended up with the Royal Air Force as a fighter pilot. When I got sent back to the Army Air Corps, they needed cargo guys. And that was a blow. But anyway, I really enjoyed my time flying the transport business in lots of parts of the country, and that got me into Berlin Airlift, so that's not all bad.
Was there ever a point as you're training, and you say your heroes were the guys defending Great Britain and all those Spitfires and the mosquito bombers and everything that they were flying over there, was there ever a point as you're pursuing these aviation dreams that you thought, you know, I might be risking my life here?
Well, growing up on the farm, I used to try to ride my brother's horse. His horse was beyond my regular skill level, and when he'd take off, I'd ride his horse. So I always had a feeling of maybe pushing the envelope a little bit there. I had no real fear of flying. A few times in the air, I questioned that decision, but I just knew that I was going to fly no matter what happens. And I had confidence in the mechanics and the equipment, and if you end up being a glider, there must be a place to land it somewhere, miss the neighbor's house and land in the field. No, I didn't ever really have any apprehension about getting up in the airplane.
Well, that's the second time that's come up, that a, you know, engine-powered aircraft could become an engineless aircraft, and you could become a glider, and it's probably a little easier to to accomplish that in that Franklin you had at first than a big cargo plane. Were there some times in your career where you had to deal with those kind of situations where you lost engine power?
Yes. Taking off out of Rio de Janeiro one day and looked out there, and all of a sudden my right engine was engulfed in flames. I mean, it was just burning. I was in the Rio de Janeiro harbor, had hardly any altitude, and there was a big fire going on. But it went through the regular procedure, feathering the engine, stopping the engine, putting out the fire extinguisher to that engine, just pull the handle and get the fire extinguisher, and put the fire out, got the engine feathered. The problem was I was maximum gross weight. I was headed from Rio de Janeiro to Brazil, northern Natal, Brazil, on the north coast. And so I was maximum gross weight, but I was at sea level. So I got there, got around on one engine and put it back down again. Well, I've had lost several engines, so to speak, and four-engine airplane, but that's no problem. If it doesn't burn up on you. Well, I've lost an engine on the airlift, too, several times. But four engines is pretty comfortable. It's not like losing one of two.
Well, and I think there are a lot of people out there saying easy for you to say, and maybe they wouldn't be so confident in that. And you mentioned Rio de Janeiro, and I guess the timeline is important on that, because probably a lot of people, and all the veterans we have on this show, you know, primarily they served in Europe, or they served somewhere in the Pacific, maybe early on they were in North Africa, maybe up in the Aleutians, but it's not very often that you hear about South America during the World War II era. But that's where you were during that time. Can you explain what you were doing and what the significance of it was?
That was unusual. You know, I put in for fighters and then up in transports. But when they assigned me, to South Atlantic Theater. And we were flying supplies from Florida all the way down to Rio de Janeiro. But that was when we had twin-engine airplanes. Then we got the C-54. Well, I was in Natal, Brazil. We were stationed in Natal, Brazil. I got assigned a C-54 then. And then we started flying out of Natal east to Ascension Island in Africa. And that was a good run. And out of Natal, we would ferry airplanes. If the guys were bringing down a bomber that was going to England to replace aircraft there, they'd go the southern route in the wintertime down to Natal to Ascension Island, then on over to Africa, and then up to England. And sometimes the airplane would break down in Natal. My buddies and I would draw straws to see who got to deliver it to England while the war was going on. But I did that a couple of times, and I enjoyed that. I had quite a lot of variety flying out of there, but flew missions mostly to Ascension Island and Africa and back to the States occasionally, and as far south as Argentina. It was a challenging environment, nothing like being shot at. Those guys always had my admiration, and I felt kind of left out, in a way, but I was doing what I was told to do, and I did the best job I could.
I hear you mention Ascension Island, and I've had some guys who, you know, made a hop there in a B-24 or a B-17 getting over to North Africa or Italy, and I've heard some horror stories about trying to find that place and the weather that you would deal with on the way there. And it strikes me that even though you didn't have people shooting at you as you're ferrying supplies or airplanes, you probably did have Mother Nature throw you a few curveballs. Any memorable instances where you thought the weather was going to take you out?
Well, of course, I've had times when severe weather, but gosh, everybody else has too. Yeah. And I trusted the instruments and the airplane, and we had a great navigator getting to Ascension. I kept that alive for about 18 months, three trips a week from Brazil to Ascension Island. We always found the island. We had a good navigator. We'd take off in the evening, and so the navigator would have the stars at night, and we didn't have too much really bad weather on that route. And one of my navigators that seemed to be more precise than most anybody, you just knew you're going to split the island 5x7. The island's only 5x7 miles. It was a Navajo Indian who had graduated from navigator school, and he was incredible. Maybe he had a sixth sense, too, but he trusted the instruments as I did. But it was an interesting trip hitting Ascension Island. There were a few that missed it and had no other place to go. You just land in the ocean. But I didn't have any real angst about that, any worry about that.
What about when World War II came to a close? Well, the war in Europe, VE Day. Was that a big deal to you? I mean, here you've been carrying all these supplies, flying all these flights, trying to support this overall effort. When you got that news that Germany had surrendered. Did that mean something?
Yeah, I meant that some of my buddies who were doing the heavy work were going to be able to come home. And it was the end of losing some of them. I've lost several buddies that, of course, as everybody has. And I was just grateful for that. And grateful that it was over for them that were doing the heavy-duty stuff. And now they get back and reacquainted with the families and start the new life. Either some stayed in the military and a lot got out. But it was a ton of weight come off your shoulders on behalf of our people in the Army and the Navy and all those that were in harm's way on behalf of freedom. It was just a new world, a new bright world out there.
You know, and as you mentioned that you were thankful for your buddies, I'm thinking back to something you told us a few minutes ago, that when you got assigned to cargo planes, you felt a little left out. Here you had dreamt about flying the fighters and all of that. Looking back now, how do you feel all about that? And does it seem to you like fighters wasn't the plan for you? And if you had been in fighters, you might not be here?
Well, that was always a possibility. So I just don't try and dwell too much on the past and say that's been done and that's the way they want it. And so you accommodate to it. But, you know, you just take the path that you're given. And if you waste time looking in the rearview mirror too long, you miss the turn off on what you might become.
And what he would become would be a living, breathing example of compassion and human kindness that would have a greater impact than he could possibly have imagined. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook to learn more about the candy bomber, Gail Halverson, as well as the educational foundation that bears his name. He just turned 100, and I'm pretty sure one of the presents he received is a lot bigger than anything we've ever gotten for our birthdays. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.